is another argument we've been having. Okay.
I wouldn't listen to us for an hour. No. And I like us. I am looking it up now.
Welcome to episode 9 of Ottawa Theater Confidential Podcast. I'm Tanya Levy, and I am here with Heather Marie Connors and Andrew Snowden.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey, friends out there in podcast land. I'm back.
It's good to have you back, Tanya.
Yay. Nice to not be busy for a day.
This is that day. So, what do we have to talk about?
Yeah, I guess we didn't really talk about what we were going to talk about before we started talking.
That's true. No,
we were almost about to do that.
I think between the three of us, there's at least three shows that we've seen. We'll be looking at This Is What Happens Next, Daniel McIver, being presented at the GCTC. Exit the King, again, and the Irving Greenberg Theatre Center, presented by Third Wall Theatre, as well as Yichud Seclusion, which is a co-production by Theatre Pass Murai and
Convergence
Theatre from Toronto, presented as part of the Magnetic North Theatre Festival, which is, that production is on at Academic Hall at the University of Ottawa.
Yeah, This Is What Happens Next is also in association with Magnetic
North. And that's right, yes. So we have two shows under Magnetic North, and one with Third Wall. Third Wall's closing production of their, I think it's 10th anniversary season.
Yeah.
So do you want to start with This Is What Happens Next?
Sure. I will have to bow out on this. Unfortunately, I did not get to see it.
It's still playing. It plays for like 80 weeks.
I was going to see it and then I couldn't get access to a car to go.
Exaggerator. It says right there, May 24th to June 12th.
Right.
So this is What Happens Next is another solo show by Daniel McIver, directed by Daniel Brooks. Obviously two really, really well-known artists in the Canadian theater canon, literally.
Yeah, pretty much. Do you want to start with that, Heather Marie?
So did you guys happen to watch the little video interview that Emma Godmere did for Ottawa Tonight with Daniel Brooks and Daniel McIver?
You know, I didn't.
Oh, it was really
I should
great.
Have, because I was around and saw them beforehand, but I haven't had a chance to yet.
It was really great. And one of the things that really resonated when I watched that interview was how they were talking about their approach to creating theater, which is similar to a few companies in Canada who are successful, and it has to do with making theater with people that whose lives you are also involved in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're friends, they've been friends for a long time, they're involved in each other's families, they, you know. And that's the case with, like, say, One Yellow Rabbit has a similar, there's a couple companies here that are like that. I picked up on that specifically in that interview, because this show, as it says in the notes, and he probably also says on stage, like, Daniel Brooks only agreed to do the show if this time it was based in truth. So,
right. There
were real things going on in Daniel McIver's life that he was talking through with his good friend Daniel Brooks, and Daniel Brooks said, we need to make this into a play, and that's, like, how it all started. But when there already is that level of trust, because there already is a close relationship there, I think it obviously makes a difference in the product that comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked this show.
Oh, thank God. Okay.
I really liked the introduction to it, you know, him coming on stage and being late and talking about what he was going to talk about and then becoming the characters and telling the story. It's a full and complete story. Tanya and I were talking about story structure earlier this morning.
Oh, okay.
And it was funny. It was touching. I don't think Daniel McIver's strength is in the whole character thing, like transitions between characters and doing voices and stuff like that. But it is the type of show, because it's so meta, where that doesn't really matter and the show doesn't depend on that. It's enough that he is an engaging and charming presence.
Rather than him putting on like multiple characters, it just becomes very definitely, it's Daniel recounting these aspects and stories, but it's Daniel pretending to be those people. So you sort of
right.
more like you're listening to a conversation with him.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a very internal play at the same time. They are different characters, but they're different aspects of Daniel McIver. It's Daniel McIver through a prism.
Yes.
And
which is what most one person shows are, right?
Right, but most one person shows are that, and either are totally unaware of it, or are aware of it and trying to patch it up. Or cover for it or something. No. You know, he gets right in there. He dissolves the barrier between the audience and himself by acknowledging the not only that he's on stage, but the entire convention, the fundamental convention of theater, which is you are waiting for something to happen next.
Yes.
Right from the get-go.
Yes.
And that is the entire point of it. But it's not, although it speaks of philosophy and has that fundamental theater philosophy idea in it, it is very real. Anyone who's ever been in a relationship long enough to have stuff in someone's in a common living space has lived some portion of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really touching right through to the end.
Yeah, and you're right. It's totally relatable.
Mm-hmm.
He's also just a really relatable guy, and there is no artifice there, which is part of just how long he's been doing this, and in general, our relationship with Daniel McIver in Canadian theater. Do you know what I mean?
There's a pedestal involved, but in some cases. But I mean, part of that's that homegrown Cape Breton. You can't pry the Cape Breton out of someone. You can't mine it out of them. Maybe that's better. But
Waka.
But even afterwards, he would. Sometimes people are a completely different person on stage and that. But now, you know, he's talking. Very easy to engage people. There's the artist who did, because the GCTC does that
thing with Marie Fritzi Gallery?
Exactly. Yeah. Where Domine has someone come in and commissions a series of paintings to go with it. It's a young artist named Alex Hamilton, and he engaged him in conversation, you know, and he's like, oh, you know, are you influenced by Rothko, that sort of thing, and they had this great conversation just off the bat. I mean, he can talk to anyone, as far as I can see.
They actually commission the works that go along with the show?
I don't know if that's the right word to use. Does that
indicate
something?
It's curated.
No, the artist is given the text to work with. And
I didn't realize they were commissioned.
Yeah.
I just thought they
curated.
I thought they
curated,
looked
yeah.
for...
This is why this... If I slip and say this kid, I'm sorry, but he looks fairly young, and he is fairly young, and he still has that verve of life. So, if I say kid, there's, but, you know, he was really nervous, because he hadn't seen it. Nobody really had seen it yet, but he'd read through it. So all the pieces have titles that relate to things in the play. This is done with all the...
Every show that's mounted in the main stage space, right?
Yeah,
the
same
the
process.
Yeah.
They don't just pull stuff from there. They're
I didn't
new
know
works.
That. That's super cool.
Yeah, and it's a shame. Not as many people know about it as should, probably. But he was really nervous as to how Daniel would see would react to it, and he had, you know, he was really actually keen on it.
Oh, great.
It was nice.
Anyway, it was a relief to see this and to enjoy it, because I had just seen a production of A Beautiful View at Centaur, which is another Daniel McIver, that was so boring.
Yeah, I take it didn't have McIver in it.
He directed it.
Oh, he directed it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Ooh. I had been, possibly by that or by something someone else had said, I had been led to, not my expectations were raised particularly, but I was more worried whether this would be a final, in quotes, solo show with a bang, or whether it would be a quiet exit under the door.
Mm-hmm.
It is with a bang. You know, that's
great
stuff.
Is this like quantifiable?
Oh, technically,
McIver is not going to perform.
That's what he
anymore?
Said in 2007 too. No.
Oh.
Well, not necessarily that he's not going to perform anymore. Don't let me put words into the gentleman's mouth, but it's in the playwright's foreword there. I suggest everybody go to the show and get a copy of the program, and that way they can read it for themselves.
Okay, so shall we move on then?
Yes, please. I'd like to contribute something.
Do you want to talk about Exit the King?
You can do that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay,
have you seen it?
Have you seen it?
I just saw it last night.
We've all seen it.
Here's the one we've all seen. Woo!
Yeah.
So, Exit the King, Eugene Ionesco.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very well-known absurdist playwright. Studied that in school and stuff. I find it interesting now when I see absurdist theater staged in the era we're in, the 21st century. I found this particular production, and I think probably just in general now that I look back on it and other absurdist pieces, is I love seeing contemporary classics performed, but certainly of that era, I'm starting to find the texts are very dated.
Mm.
And that the themes, while they are still relevant, the way that they were written then are in a way that it's not really bringing anything new to the way we see things today. And I think that sets anybody up who's going to be staging these things for an uphill challenge. You know, everybody thinks about death and, you know, how the end comes. But it's just the words that are used, it's like, it was like listening to scripts from television in the 60s or 70s, and it's just like, it's a vernacular that's used from like my grandparents and even possibly my parents' time and how they would refer to it. But it's like now, because I guess maybe it's not old enough to be a point where I'm like, wow, they really thought like that back then, way back then. But yet it's still, it's like close enough that it's like, it sounds like going home, and if my parents and
it's
stuff
just
are talking
on that,
about
it's
it.
Just
yeah.
on that edge where it's like something's about this dialogue, but
yeah
it's
kind
of gives
just
me kind
not
of a,
old enough.
A John Donne feeling to the entire thing, right?
Yeah.
But
the production itself, like I found the production design was really visually punchy and really lush, so there was a lot to look at. Choices in music were interesting. I mean, there's I really, really liked seeing Andy Massingham being able to do a lot more physical work again. And that's funny, because the last time I saw Andy, I was on stage with Andy. So seeing him being in a Shakespeare and not getting into physical theater, which is really his medium, and now being able to sit back and watch him do what he does so well was great. He, you know, the embodiment of the king was so close to someone I actually know very, very well that I was like, wow, I feel like I'm watching someone pretending to be my friend on stage. And, that was really neat. I liked Simon Bradshaw as the little soldier guard on the side. That was great. I think I would like to hire him for parties and just have him stand at the door and make random announcements and, like, go bob up and down in his helmet.
He's gotta have that helmet. The helmet was the best.
Okay, everybody here loved that. Yeah, no, I loved it too.
I found I found Annie Lefebvre. Now, her hair and makeup was amazing, like unbelievable. And I knew from way back when that, you know, she had this talent, but now that she's gone to Toronto, studied at this like super super reputable school and now come back, it's amazing. I looked at Katie Bunting and I'm like, she looks like an anime character. Like, I kept wanting her to like have Japanese superpowers.
To be fair, she normally looks a bit like an anime character.
Okay, all right.
It's true.
Yeah, I agree. The makeup and the hair and the costumes as well. The design, the set design, I mean, is just really the giant rocking chair is the thing that's, you know, gonna stick in my brain. Mm-hmm. Does anybody know, was that something that they got from the NAC or?
I believe so. I don't remember exactly where they said they got it. I was there for the first read, right? And that's where Sarah presented her vision for the, I think I can say that, where she presented her vision for the set and that, so. And she was talking about this 7-foot rocking chair. And then the next time I went into Arts Court for something completely unrelated, here they are, all of Third Wall, standing in the hallway with the 7-foot rocking chair trying to get it into the little elevator, which required some disassembly, reassembly, and then they were...
Right.
I think they got it from the NAC. I don't recall exactly. It's beautiful.
It is beautiful. And I looked at it and I thought, I don't think she built that. I think she got that from somewhere.
No, they did redo it. Like, they had to take it apart and put it back together, basically.
But even if the show had just been Andy Massingham and that giant rocking chair, I think that would have been enough.
Yeah.
No, and that's not to really slight anybody else, but if you... That alone is worth the ticket price. If you go and you just stare at Andy the entire time that he's on stage, which is most to all of the time,
you have
made your money. You've made your money back. There is... But that's not necessarily against anyone else. There are a couple of shortcomings in the show, though. Overall, I mean,
that you would attribute to the production or to the script. Or both.
Both. The script is, well, yeah, it's a little bit dated. It's very poetic.
He says as he rolls his eyes.
There were moments where I was looking at that just based on, like, now the way that theatrical conventions have moved from absurdism. And I mean, like, I think modern theater still has roots in that type of genre. But I literally was, like, thinking, dude, you've had, like, 5 endings. Could you not have cut 10 pages out of this text?
This is with Ionesco's own edits.
I know.
There are significant X marks in the text from its full length.
Really?
That's the other thing. I love the text in that it is real.
Yeah.
If you've ever watched someone progress through death, in the long term, that is it. Exit the King cures procrastination, maybe later. But the thing is, yeah, it is a little bit dated. It is an epic poem. It's a huge eulogy, but it's a personal internal eulogy. When I say John Donne, I mean, this enters into biographical criticism. Ionesco wrote it in the same circumstances as John Donne wrote all his depressing stuff about life and ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee, Europe washing promontories off and whatnot. It's the same kind of thing, because that was when Ionesco was ill as well. So, you know, he was looking right up against this stuff, very concerned with his own mortality. So it is very personal. It becomes universal in that way. Towards the end, the text, all the way along, most of that physical stuff is provided for in the text. It's cued along, you know.
Yes.
The playwrights
yes.
put it in there. That's why you end up with certain items on the stage that don't get touched for a long period of time, which is another problem. But the end portion of it, where you only have two characters, is full of imagery, but not any direction to actually have the imagery. I don't think it works unless it's directed perfectly or unless the actors change. There's supposed to be a tenderness change there that I did not see. And when you come across it in the text at first, if you're anything like me, I guess, your first reaction is, oh dear God, is this not going to be long on stage? Mm-hmm. So I don't think that they fully succeeded in not making it long.
Yeah. I actually really like the way that you just explained that, because and it's interesting to hear, Tanya, what you have to say about the script, because I really liked the text. I've never studied it, and I've never seen it before, but I'm a sucker for good writing, you know, and there's so many good lines in the play.
There's so many romantic lines.
Yes.
Right, that it's just...
It's, and the sentiment of the whole thing, and this idea of the world only existing because you exist, and all of that stuff I loved. I did find it dragged a little bit, and I kept trying to figure out what was missing. Do you know what I mean? And I couldn't make my mind up about Mary Ellis.
Yeah.
Because there were moments, I think there are a lot of reasons why she's perfect for that role.
Mm-hmm.
And there were moments that I really liked her, and then there were times where I thought, I don't know if this works.
It's because there's supposed to be that switch. Both of the queens are supposed to be two-dimensional characters. Not just one-dimensional, but they're supposed to make that switch from one aspect to the other as the progression goes. Now, Katie does it very, very quickly, and there's that whole where I guess you could say from curry combing the ego to but what about me, you know, that which are two sides of the same coin, and you're supposed to have that tough love and sincere, tender, motherly love, the grandmotherly kindness from the other one, which you do get, but not all the way through where it's needed. And I don't know if that's Mary Ellis. I don't know if it's the direction, and I'm not sure where. I just but it didn't fail because of that. It's just I wish that would have been pointed up a little bit, you know, something with lighting, something with scenery. I don't know.
I was talking with someone last night about portions of the staging, and the one thing that I found that was needed for comprehension of what's going on is there is so much talk about the world falling apart and being destroyed. It was not reflected.
Right.
And that's a key component of the things falling around you. Things like the most obvious thing for me was the fact that there was a tear in the curtain, and they said, oh, it got bigger, and they're all staring at it, and I'm staring at it, and I'm like, no, it didn't. That's an issue for me. Like,
yeah, it's supposed
you need to arrange somehow that if you're going to show it's being bigger, then make it bigger. And if that means that you have a zipper on it that someone can rig with a fishing line, or if it means that you have curtains that you slightly pull the Velcro off more and more so it starts to fall apart, then
gradually.
You do that gradually. But there needed to be more chaos of the world falling apart that wasn't there.
That's a good point, because there wasn't a lot happening on stage that supported all of that text.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a lot of text, and I think that's where your attention can wane, because
mm-hmm.
you've essentially got, you know, all the characters standing in a line while
mm-hmm.
one of them speaks.
That's the thing. That's why it's written as a farce, because you do need that kind of, you do need, if you're going to make it theater and not an epic poem that nobody's going to read, you have to you have to balance out the heaviness of the text, which is basically one long death scene.
Yes.
It is, if you thought Hamlet took a long time to die on stage, this is, but you have to have that element of farce. And there were maybe, well, Andy's physical, and Kat Smiley could keep up with him.
She was her.
Between the two of them. I mean, that's it's tantamount to a clown show, and it's great.
Yeah.
You know, she can match him, which is great. And then you have Richard Jelinek doing this wonderful little deadpan, which is and Simonoff in the corner.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you need more movement. You need more movement.
Mm-hmm. I felt like
it's. I know it's difficult. Well, I'm not directing it, huh? But. You can't take any attention away from Andy, because it's he's hair triggering around there, but you have to have some movement, some of that element of farce, some of that element of chaos, then use the stillness to highlight moments.
Right, because if the characters are sitting on stage waiting for the king to die, then we are sitting in the audience waiting for the king to die. And
we're sitting on the audience in the audience, waiting for the characters to move, with one eye on the wheelchair, which was brought in when UNESCO said to bring it in, but hasn't been touched since because UNESCO hasn't said to touch it since. That's the problem. It's minor things like that, and because we can only afford to nitpick, because there is so much about the play and the production, and specifically Andy. I don't feel bad about singling out Andy as being the greatest thing about the show. That are good. That we can.
Yeah. Say. Simon Bradshaw, excellent voice work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And that was
excellent physical work. Frankly, excellent physical work that he has to stand on stage during the entire time. And the little movement that he does is comical.
You could see, like, the one thing that I loved about Simon is if you made the effort and you look through the eye slots, he was. His face was changing in the helmet.
Of course it was.
It was amazing. But
how could you expect any less? That's why they're up there. They are a good. They're a good team.
Yeah.
Like, well, they're all good individuals. They're a decent team.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they it's a good example of what you might term an all-star cast.
Yeah, I liked Katie Bunting in this too. I don't know how people felt about her in that, but I liked her.
She's supposed to be melodramatic, and she can pull off the melodrama.
She is like a cartoon. Yeah. She is,
yeah.
You know,
she can be, but yeah.
She's
great.
Well, they all are cartoons on there, you know, and some of them slide into it more easily than others. Little bits of business between Richard and Simon are fun too.
Yeah,
they have fun with that show.
Yeah.
And difficult space for it, with no wings.
Oh, yeah. I want to say something about the space.
And also the bloody collapsing chairs. Who was there on opening night besides me?
No.
Remember during Undercurrents when we might have to cut this off the tape and send it as a letter through to the GCTC, but. The way the chairs are set up in the studio, they're set up on risers, right? And the backs of the chairs are very close to the edge of the risers, which are hollow, unlike in some other spaces. During each one of the Undercurrent shows I attended, at least one of the chairs somewhere fell into the back.
Fell into the crack. Things that happened once.
Oh, that's awful.
During the back legs. During Exit the King, like from what I could tell out of the corner of my ear, maybe three at the same time fell into the crowd.
Oh, that's
like,
awful.
It's loud, B, it's a hazard. And
yes.
Of course, the cast rode over it. You know, you could have dropped an atom bomb in the aisle and they wouldn't have noticed. They're good. They know the craft, right? But, it's...
Well, that's a whole other conversation. When something like that happens, do you just push on as though nothing just happened? But anyway.
If nobody dies.
That's really dangerous. Because, you know, there's a lot of old people who go to theater. And
that's what the general manager is for. To check if the old people have fallen into the crack.
Yeah, that's...
that's not for the actors.
Yeah, well.
Let the show go on.
Yeah. Well, the show has to go on, but it's, most of the time it's ridiculous when something happens to have everyone pretend that nothing happened. And that actually annoys me as an audience member when that goes on. It depends what it is. There are some things that obviously you would ignore, but anyway. My complaint about the space, and I'm totally going to sound like Alvina here, but it needs to be said.
Who better to sound like?
There was something about the room when they closed the doors to the theater. It was really stuffy in there, and I don't know if it was dust or some kind of mold or what, but there was something that, like, literally my sinuses became plugged and my throat started to hurt. And there were people around me, like, sniffing and coughing, so I know I wasn't the only one. There was, like, a lack of air, or there was dusty air, or there was something about that space.
You may be right. The air quality in there is a little
And I started to look at, like, the blacks going, I wonder how clean those are. And, like, you know, it just, that was not good.
Okay.
It wasn't a pleasant space to be in, so that wasn't good.
I mean, it's a good space and good things can be done with it, but you're right. Maybe it does need a little bit of a simonizing.
Well, if I could physically feel it, then yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
That was Exit the King. Oh, yeah.
Now, because I like to say it because I can speak Hebrew. So, last night, Andrew and I saw the opening of Yehud Seclusion.
Oh, yeah.
At Academic Hall at the University of Ottawa. Now, I want to say, because I actually shotgunned Andrew for being able to say this on the podcast. When you get to Academic Hall, if you look up, and yes, you can actually try and convince former graduates of the theater department that sign has always been there. Half of them will actually think it's true. It was a game last night that convinced, like, oh, wow, I never even noticed that was always there. Oh, yeah, that was always there. There's a sign in the archway above Academic Hall that basically denotes it like you're going into a synagogue. There's a big Star of David, and underneath it, there's Hebrew writing. And I've spent my time outside, myself obviously being Jewish, if you don't know, I am, trying to read what the heck that said. So I was thinking, I could tell it said the first word was Beit, and Beit denotes a temple, or that you're going into a synagogue, or house is what it means. And then there was two words that I was unfamiliar with. The second one was Ma'abar, and the third one that was Lichomot. So, Beit Ma'abar Lichomot, I was like, okay, so they're saying that the name of the synagogue that they're in is Beit Ma'abar Lichomot, but what does Ma'abar and Lichomot mean? So, I spent my evening on my iPhone trying to translate this, and I had, like, Ma'abar means, like, a passage or a ford or going forward or journeying outside or something like that, and then Lichomot is, Chomot are walls or... you know, originally I had thought they were saying temple hole in the wall, but one of my friends on Facebook, who I went to Hebrew school with, wrote back and said, well, it's like passage outside the wall. And in conversing with Jordan Peddle at the opening night party afterwards, I found out that sign was outside of Theater Pas Mirai, and it is in fact a Hebrew approximation of Theater Pas Mirai at the house outside the walls.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a really, really kind of special thing as you go in. Myself, having been to Jewish weddings and this being part of my culture, I went in and I was amazed at how accurate and immersive and true to life the characterizations and the setup and the partying that they had going on reminded me of my cultural heritage. To the point, I was in a halter dress, and we're dealing with an Orthodox wedding. I literally went in and started to freak out because I had uncovered skin at my shoulders and my arms and started to wrap myself up and had to tell myself, chill out, it's a play. You go in, there is a big, like in Yiddish or in Hebrew, they call it a simcha, which is a big party and festivities. So there's a big simcha, and there's the men on one side, and the women are in the actual academic hall, which would be normal for a Jewish wedding in an Orthodox fashion. Men and women are separated, and they party themselves on separate sides. So the men are having a rousing, dancing, singing, drinking plum wine festivity. And on the inside, the women are dancing, but you can also go to the bride, who is there with her mother. And on a wedding day, a bride is said that she has a direct passage to God to say prayers, sort of to benefit anybody, so everybody can go up and get a blessing from the bride. And that is part of the opening to the first 15 minutes before the show starts.
That's so cool.
Oh, yeah. No, it is so cool. I mean, now, this isn't my culture. I'm familiar enough with it to, read Mad Magazine. and that. But you feel like you are at a wedding. The closest thing I have direct experience with is an Italian wedding, and it's an Italian wedding turned up.
I mean, it's wild. They even had on the table. They have a picture, of them as children, the groom and the bride, and a wedding registry. And there is a basket of yarmulkes
for men to take. Many people didn't realize to take, which I don't understand.
Yeah.
But still, no, and.
Andrew wore one.
You had your choice. Of course, I wore one. Everyone, Brad Long was there, but he came with a hat, so that's okay. But yeah, no, John Coneskin looks cute with a yarmulke.
Yeah,
on too.
John Coneskin had a yarmulke. Pierre Brault had a yarmulke on, and he was dancing the hora with the actors and singing the songs.
Yay!
It is so immersive. You have your choice of sitting. The Academic Hall. I'm familiar enough with the Academic Hall.
Ottawa's oldest theater.
Ottawa's, according to the University of Ottawa website, I can cite my source whether or not we all agree with them. We had a debate about that last night afterwards.
But is actually the oldest building on campus.
It's the oldest.
Or one of the oldest.
Let's not go into.
All right. Okay. So, anyways, yes.
Sorry.
It's completely changed. I mean, just the little touches, and there, some of the pictures are changed in the lobby. That you wouldn't notice, but they're done well enough unless you stand there staring at the Three Penny Opera shots all the time.
Which I do too.
But, so you'll notice that's changed too, and they've taken full advantage of the space, of the stage space.
You literally feel you are in a synagogue.
Oh,
it
you
is
think
you
are in a
synagogue.
Not only that, you feel that you are in... except I've never been that far back in a synagogue. Because they have the seating on both sides of the stage.
Cool.
Like
it's actually
regular
built like
seating
corridor style.
And whereas normally that could be an impediment to sight lines, it's not really. There are one or two cases where it's like, oh, well, I know I'm not sitting, I can't see something. Other than that, the performers perform to everyone. It doesn't matter where you sit, really.
And it's authentic. Like, you have all of the people at the beginning before the show starts. They'll come up, they talk to you, they engage with you. All of the performers are very proactive to make you feel welcome, down to the point that when I was in the section with the women before the show started, that the actress who was playing the mother said to me, she's like, you can also go in and watch the section with the boys. That's okay. Just in case, because the Jewish tradition is that you can't do that. So they even went as far as to make sure that, you felt welcome to go and that it was okay to mix where you wouldn't normally be allowed. Now,
there's absolutely nothing hokey about it. Yeah. There's no feeling that, oh, we are being set up for a wedding. No, you are at a wedding.
Yeah.
You are at a wedding. I don't even like weddings, and I like this wedding. You are at a wedding, and that complete suspension of not even disbelief, but the suspension of the outside world, the complete immersion in it.
Yeah.
And it is an excellent performance. All of the things that might normally be going through someone's over analytical mind, like, oh, this is exposition, or, where did that storyline go?
Someone's analytical mind.
Yeah, someone trained me. but seriously, none of that. No. You are watching what is happening.
Yeah, it's really neat the way that they set it up, is there's several storylines going. So you have the main couple, And I wonder if we have one of
I
those
have a program.
Things. Anyways, one thing that's interesting is this was written by Julie Tepperman, who plays Rachel. So she's the woman. And then Chaim, the man that she's marrying, who I believe is Aaron Wills, or is it Aaron Willis?
Let's find out here.
Aaron Willis.
Aaron Willis.
Aaron Willis is actually her husband in real life.
Yeah.
And they worked on this together to develop this show. So you have the story of this couple who, you know, had basically their marriage. They choose each other, and they, as in Judaism, you only go on a couple of dates that are entirely supervised. You've never actually get to spend...
Very
Orthodox Judaism. Very
Orthodox
Judaism, yeah. You get to... you have to be on supervised dates. Usually you're looking about 4, 5, 6 dates, and then you figure out whether or not this is the person that you want to marry. So Yichud is a special room in the synagogue that the bride and the groom are supposed to fast on the day of their wedding, and they don't eat until after this ceremony when they go to the Yichud room. And the Yichud room is where there's food, they break their fast together, they share their first meal, and it is the first time they are ever allowed to be alone together. So it's a special moment, and it really comes across. But it's not all just focused on the couple getting married. There are several other storylines. There's the mother and father of the bride that have their own storyline, and they have the two older brothers of the groom and their own issues that they have. They have their own animosity, and then their own individual storylines, and all of those people are having not so good a time. And then you have the couple who everybody thinks, why the hell are they getting married? What is this going to make? This makes no sense. It doesn't. And they're the ones that really have their stuff together.
Yeah.
And the thing that I found really, really awesome about this is that it puts a humanity on people who are Orthodox in any religion, even, that they're normal people. They think of the same things that we do. They have the same interests, the same insecurities, the same cultural experience to an extent. And they're making references to pop culture. There's references to Facebook. There's references to iPhones. You know, they're not...
And not contrived.
And not contrived. Completely
either.
Organic.
Nothing
completely organic.
Contrived.
And it's... They're human beings. And you see, you know, I can relate to them because, look, they speak the same language I do. They do the same things I do. And it really humanized an element of Jewish culture that I feel right now in contemporary media, especially without getting too far into politics, is portrayed as backwards and angry and, is got
tribal.
A tribal and very, very, very negative light right now. And this totally turns that on its ear and brings a humanity back to it. The acting is phenomenal. The script is
engaging. I want to go ahead and say, you don't have to have any kind of a personal investment in Judaism.
No, not at all.
Or any real knowledge of it.
No.
To be immersed in it. Because all that you need to know is there in front of you.
Absolutely.
Now, if you do, there are a couple of extra things that you'll pick up on
that are
extra hilarity.
Like Andrew and I, like I know from that being basically my cultural background, there were things I picked up on. But basically, you've literally got... If you have no experience with Jewish culture and you've never met a Jewish person, you will go in and you will literally have a full tasty sundae in front of you. But if you can speak Yiddish or Hebrew or you know anything about Judaism, you get an extra cherry on top is basically
That's right. It's like, you know, Mambo Italiano or
exactly.
A big fat Greek wedding.
Exactly.
Do you need to be part of those cultures or have any experience with them? No,
yeah.
That's part of what's presented to you.
Yeah. And the structure of the show I found
acting.
As well as... It's really, really lively. There's a beautiful scene of the ceremony. They don't do a full wedding ceremony, but you get little snippets of the very common rituals that are associated with Jewish marriage. Under the chuppah, which is the canopy, you have the ring exchange, the drinking of the wine, the wife circling the husband, and the breaking of the glass, which is very, very common, and they're very particular to Jewish weddings. But the way the stories all tie in together, and there's great body humor, and all of the blessings are authentic to the point that I was actually even a bit shocked that they weren't making adjustments, because generally blessings are not supposed to be said out of the context of things really happening.
She's not
so there
Orthodox.
Were a couple. Yeah, I mean, it was weird for me to hear them being said that way, because, you know, if they did that in Tel Aviv, they'd have picket lines out front of their show. But the stories themselves, you end up with, and I won't give too much away about it, but you end up with three unhappy endings, but it's all tempered by the fact that the show ends with the most beautiful beginning. And that's...
Yeah. That would be
basically what I can say about that.
Of putting it. I would also like to say that with the use of the space, you have things that are happening concurrently.
Yeah.
That you see in sequence that are separated out in space very well, perfectly. So that you know that they're happening at the same time, but because of the spatial separation, they can each be given their attention. And then you have the Yehud part, where the same space is used both for the outside and for the inside at different times. So those are two things that are going on at the same time, but you get them in their entirety as well. It's all done great.
Yeah. And the cool thing that I found as well with the concept of Yehud, which is why I think they also put in brackets next to the title seclusion, is that the most relevant things in the plot and in the development of these characters all happen when two people are alone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, did we talk about the chorus?
Let's talk about the chorus.
Why not? And the klezmer band.
And the klezmer band. There's a big, big chorus. There are several people in, there was a bit of a partnership with Ottawa Theatre School. Diego Arvelo and Jody Morden were part of the chorus that was sort of hooked up. That they actually went to Toronto and they performed in the chorus there.
So did
and
some
then,
of the others, right? They, I know Stephanie
DiGaetano, she just did in Ottawa. That I know.
She said that she went to...
Did she do Toronto?
Well, they
oh,
all had to go to Toronto.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know about performing, but they all had to go and at least rehearse in Toronto.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So so that's really nice that you have all these local performers who are also part of it. And there's a klezmer band. You have a drummer, an accordion player, and a clarinet player. So there's some live klezmer music as well.
Yes.
Really quite awesome. There's plenty of traditional Jewish dancing.
And you might expect Hava Negela, but it only comes up once.
And
we're
it's
not
on
gonna
a cell
say
phone. That's
that
so
was
good. That was amazing. That was so good. But it's the costumes are so authentic. I was literally like looking at that going, oh my goodness, I actually know a Rebbetzin who looks like that. I saw her at Yom Kippur last time I went to shul, and there was like a woman who was like super pregnant, and they all have terrible Orthodox style wigs. It's great.
Yeah.
Those are not just wigs. They actually mastered the art of the scheidel. Scheidel is Yiddish for wig, so.
The mother was authentic.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
The father, too, but, everybody, just watch it. Go.
Yeah.
Not one person has had anything bad to say about it.
No. No, I've had, everybody came out of that being super, super excited. There was not very many, as far as I could tell, at least not many Jewish people were there, not super obviously Jewish. I mean, sort of like, you know, okay, I know Fran Perl and Judy Perl were there and Tibor and Gavari and whatever, but it was nice to see a lot of the crowd wasn't just, you know, it's not an ethnic play. It's not a demographic, you know, it's not just going to appeal to the Jewish community. It's global in its reach and it's so enjoyable. So enjoyable.
It's not about Judaism at all. It's just in the context, in the setting of Judaism. It's about it's about relationships.
Yeah.
It's about marriage.
Yeah.
It's really about marriage. It's about, but it's about
and knowing people. Knowing someone.
People.
How well do you know someone, and how do you
and
get
how
to
can
know?
You know them?
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What's enough time to get to know them? Some people, you know, you can. Quote unquote, know them for a lifetime, but you really don't know them. And then you see, after, I don't know, I've spent a cumulative total of 8 hours with you, and you make the right choice and you really do know them. Or you don't know them, and then you find out, my goodness, My instincts were right. The little pieces that I saw of you are true, and it's even better than I had imagined.
Yeah.
It's very, very uplifting, and it ends really optimistically, and it's just, it's a beautiful experience.
It is.
Take people who've never been to a play to this, and they will enjoy themselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, some of the material
people
is...
People are, like, clapping and stomping.
Clapping and stomping. Some of the material is right on the edge.
Yeah.
But it addresses it, and it doesn't address it in a necessarily judgmental manner. You can throw a lot of it onto the characters,
yeah,
which is fine. There's no indictment.
Yeah.
There's no indictment of... I think it's a great validator for religion or any ideological, because these are the frames of reference that we as human beings use,
yeah,
to understand, categorize, and give a basis for what to do with the world around us, even if it's just to the degree that, you know, my rabbi says nothing about this.
My one thing that I really, really want to give credit to this production for is that everybody was authentically Jewish, and there were no stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really well done in that respect. There's a lot of respect given to people who are Orthodox Jews, but there was no stereotypes, which was a concern of mine going in. You know, how
right,
much are they going to
sure.
play that up? And they didn't. They just made it true.
Great. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. Probably by the time this comes out, it will be done here. But I mean, this has been around for a while.
It's still worth talking
about. Oh, it is worth talking about. Thank you, Magnetic North, for bringing it here. Whoever, all of the above. Just brilliant.
I didn't get that program.
You didn't get this program?
No, they didn't give it to me.
You can look at my program.
I'd love to. It's got a pretty picture on the front.
It's
so, look at some stuff coming up. We are going to have a busy month this month. We're recording every Saturday in June. Ottawa Theatre Confidential podcast listeners, you can expect to get...
One of those Saturdays might be a Sunday.
All of your money's worth, which is no money. But
you'll get all that money.
But if you want to send money, we'll put it towards keeping the podcast going. We're not a registered charity. Don't ask for a tax receipt. but there's some things coming up. There's a fundraiser for the Ottawa Fringe Festival that's happening Wednesday, June 8th.
Yeah. Playing with Fire.
At
Zen Kitchen. Yeah. Hosted by Media Style, mm-hmm, who, you know, they could put on a party in a back alley, and it would be the best party. That's just hands down. There are posters for it up all over town. They're quite visible. I'm excited. I know there will be a few surprises in store. I don't know exactly what they all are. Some of them may be in print. I don't know. But it's gonna be fun. It's gonna be fun.
Yeah.
And then we get, well, let's see, we got the rest of Magnetic North.
Yeah.
If you want to hang out at the festival bar all week and get yourself toughened up for those late night fringe courtyard, do it. Because you never know who will show
up.
I recommend the noodle bowls. Oh my god. Well, they have it on the menu, right?
Where?
At the Magnetic North.
At the bar?
Festival bar. So you go in, you buy drink tickets and whatever else, right? And I'm looking at the menu here, and I'm like, I was hungry because I had not really sat down for a meal all day. So I'm looking down, it's like assorted nuts, assorted fruit, bowl, whatever. I see people walking by with hors d'oeuvres, but it's nothing really substantial. It's like, noodle bowl, $2. I'm like, okay, I'll take one of those. So they give me a couple of tickets with noodle bowl written across the back. I go in. There's four volunteers behind the festival bar. They haven't cheaped out on it. You know, the service is fast. And with a smile. Even when I hand... Well, okay. Maybe for a moment. When I handed them the noodle bowl ticket and they took a big, deep, collective sigh. So they've got these... Up behind them on the shelf, they've got these stacks of kimchi noodle bowls. like you would get off the rack at Loblaws. And the poor people have to, you know, fill it with water and microwave it or whatever. Now, I don't know whether they put it in from a kettle or not, then hand it to me with a fork.
Are you serious?
I was not the only one who got one, but I got one.
That's hilarious.
And it's like, oh, I feel so bad for putting you through this, but
for making them put hot water in a disposable bowl.
But it's so. I mean, what do you, bring a noodle bowl onto the dance floor? Which I then proceeded to do.
I don't remember them having, like, an extensive menu last time around.
Well, maybe they hid it after, but this was at the ticket table, because it's, no, you can't just walk up out of the blue and be like, hi, I have cash, I would like a noodle bowl. No, you have to premeditatedly buy a noodle bowl. Yeah, everyone showed up that thing last night. Someone who looked like Daniel McIver, but I'm pretty sure wasn't. Although everyone else thinks he was. I don't think so.
He sent his doppelganger.
He has a few. Sheila Copps apparently showed up. I saw Sarah McVee and a couple of people that she's working on a project with.
Were they hot ladies?
Yes.
Because I saw Sarah
They
McVee.
All were.
I saw Sarah McVee and a couple of hot. Well, Sarah McVee is also hot. Her
yes,
and
we,
two
we,
other
we just
hot
want to
ladies.
Make, everybody's hot. Oh Lord.
Yeah,
their names are Amy and Haley, and I might have to. I don't know what they're all. Yeah, you know, they were excited talking about their project, which I won't talk about because I don't know too much about it more than what they said. Yeah, I know a lot of people. Came out for the after ceremony, after party, I mean. And then we just sort of blur into Fringe, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
Oh, and Country Shaped Like Stars is coming up on Tuesday.
True. Yes, and you got a ticket?
I got a ticket well in advance.
Good.
Yes. Yeah. I have a history of not seeing it.
Of course, it's dangerous now, right? Because
it's been hyped, but not to the degree that it's been super hyped. I know when it reaches that point where it's like, I can never see Fight Club, because for like 4 years I was told you've got to see Fight Club by the same few people. And then by that point, someone eventually walked up to me and said, don't bother seeing Fight Club. It's been hyped up too much for you. Like, okay, but yeah, no, I will still be excited to see Countries.
As long as you do what people tell you to do, that's all that matters.
But I, if you don't take recommendations, you don't know whose recommendations to take.
But speaking of Fringe, I do want to do a little plug for my artist series.
Go, plug away.
Please do.
I'm doing like an industry series for the Fringe that runs the second week, June 20th to 24th.
And I think that listeners of Ottawa Theatre Confidential, there's a couple of events specifically that I think would interest you. One of them involves our very own Andrew Snowden, and that's on Monday, June 20th, starting at 4 p.m. in the Fringe Courtyard, which is also known as the Beer Tent. We're going to have a panel discussion called Reviewing the Reviewer. So there'll be a whole panel of people who review theater, and that includes Mr. Andrew Snowden.
But more importantly, it includes Patrick Langston from the Ottawa Citizen, Alvina Ruprecht from CBC Radio, and Ken Godmere from Ottawa Tonight.
Yes.
Is there anybody else?
Yeah, Connie Meng from North Country Public Radio.
Oh, wow! From upstate New York.
Yes.
Oh, my.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Okay.
And
international flavor.
And there's going to be someone from Can Culture Magazine as well.
Okay.
Which is another online publication. So,
Are you going to be brave and serve both as Apartment 613 and Ottawa Theatre Confidential?
Andrew will be there representing Apartment 613.
Yeah, definitely. That's what we've all...
Yeah.
Agreed. I mean, talk about
it. So that'll be a really interesting discussion, because we're going to talk about, you know, obviously the whole changing media landscape with so many online sources for reviews now versus the dwindling coverage in traditional media sources like newspaper and radio. And so just...
How the individual reviewers are still pushing for it and still finding ways to, hopefully, anyways. I'm on the panel, damn. That's sinking in slowly, but how that is important too.
Sure.
And how that has possibly, I think personally that it's been stimulated by the online thing, but that may be That may be collective ego. But the
so anyway, you can see there's lots of interesting tidbits involved.
I hope that's
in that,
recorded because I'm not gonna be listening when I'm up there.
the second one I want to plug the series runs all week from Monday to Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. in the courtyard. But the second one I want to specifically plug is on the Tuesday, June 21st, is a panel called Theater, Politics, and Social Change. Mm. And so the themes involved in that, I feel like, are things that we also talk about on the podcast from time to time. And so there will be people on that panel who have different approaches to dealing with social issues through theater, as well as people who have a background and experience in this sort of thing, so they have a unique perspective on it. An example would be a gentleman who has been mentioned a couple of times already, Tibor Igarvari.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. Yes. As well as Eleanor Crowder, who back in the day worked with Augusta Boal. She's all over Forum Theater, does a lot of like grassroots community-based stuff. We'll have Rob Salerno, who does the show Fucking Stephen Harper. So there's going to be like a wide range. And Tibor actually is, as he told me, he thinks he will be the dissenting voice on the panel because he's someone who believes that theater shouldn't be used and can't be used to affect any kind of change in society. So that will also be a really interesting conversation that I'm totally.
So he's going to be taking the David Mamet role, even though I can point to at least one thing that he was involved in recently that is the exact opposite of that. No, but
well,
but
his work is very grassroots, and yet he has very specific opinions about the actual effect of theater and its place in society. So.
I'm only anticipating what he's going to say, and I'm saying maybe, you know, to a certain degree that is true. Well, I'm glad I will be able to listen to that and watch that.
It'll be totally fascinating. So autofringe.com is the place to find out all things Fringe, including the series, and that is the end of my plug. Does anybody have anything else they want to...
Besides seeing the rest of your series,
Little Prince opens this
weekend.
Oh, yeah,
Little Prince. That's right. That's true. We've talked about it a lot.
And there's other shows that open with Mag North as well.
I can remember all of them, whether or not people involved
well,
in the festival.
Well, you know, check out the web.
Pick up a program.
Iowa
if you're
Fringe.
Anywhere downtown Ottawa, you can't miss the programs and stuff.
As Tanya said, Ottawa Theatre Confidential will be every week in June because there's a lot of theater to cover. So,
and we'll have some extra special things that we'll talk about on the next podcast revolving around Fringe because we're going to get even more hardcore.
Yes.
There
if it were possible for this podcast to become more hardcore, that's what it will do.
And with that, I think we'll wrap things up. As always, thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you for your
hospitality.
Hope you enjoyed the croissants and berries.
Thanks for breakfast, Tanya.
You're welcome.
Until next time.
Take care. Watch some plays.
That sounds good.
Is that your Super Bowl?
Did you ask me that last night?
No.
Someone
I
else
see
did.
You last night.
I wouldn't mind going to that show.
Yeah.
Yeah.